Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why do so many jobs go unfilled in America, even with so many people desperate to find work? The Bureau of Labor Statistics reports a little changed unemployment rate for May, 8.2%, or about 12.7 million Americans. Meanwhile, some companies say they simply can't find anybody with the right combination of attributes and experience to do the work they're hiring for. My guest today says the problem may not be the applicants at all, but the fact that employers are asking for the impossible and replacing the human touch in human resources with computer screening software. Peter Capelli is professor of management and director of the Center for Human Resources at the Wharton School. His new book is called Why Good People Can't Get Jobs, The Skills Gap and What Companies Can Do About It. Peter, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
So when employers talk about their inability to find good candidates for particular jobs, they tend to blame the job seekers. They don't have enough education. They don't have enough experience. What got you thinking that those perceptions of who is out there might, in fact, be inaccurate?
Well, I guess initially it just doesn't sound credible, right? There's nothing much that's changed in the economy in the last couple of years or so that would cause the jobs to require lots more than they've required in the past. The applicant pool every year gets better in terms of the experience base of people out there. And, you know, more to the point, when you start looking at some of the evidence that underpins the story, it's just not there. You know, the simple story is that employers can't find people they want because the applicants are not qualified, and then that's usually followed by saying the schools are failing and that's the problem. When you look at what employers actually say when they are surveyed, especially the hiring managers, you know, they're really not complaining about academic skills. They're way far down the list. And the things they complain about are the same things employers have complained about for 30 years. Especially among young people, and that is, you know, we want somebody who's more mature, somebody who's more diligent, somebody who is, you know, has better work attitudes, all that sort of stuff.
That generation thing is so interesting to me. I'm a member of Generation X, and for a long time, everybody older than me, the baby boomers, kind of wrung their hands, and now my generation is doing this about the millennials. Is it just something that happens every time?
Well, it's a very good point. Actually, that all those distinctions, you know, millennials, Gen X, Gen Y, Gen Q, Gen H, whoever's cooking it up, it's all cooked up by consultants. The demographers who look at that don't actually see any distinctions at all. What they see are age effects. That is, 20-year-olds are always different than 30-year-olds, who are always different than 40 and 50-year-olds. And I think you're exactly right that, you know, the older generation always complains about the younger generation, and a lot of the complaints are perfectly realistic and perfectly understandable. You know, 20-year-olds are not as diligent as they will be later in their life. They're not as mature. They're not as conscientious. But there's nothing new about that. It's not that suddenly the applicants coming out of school are not good enough. They used to be good enough. You know, what happened?
Is it especially difficult now in this climate, though, for young college graduates to get that first real job out of school?
Oh, yeah. And I think the reason comes when you start looking at what it is employers want. What are the skills they can't find? What they want is somebody who has done the same job before.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody wants people with job experience. And the reason for that, understandably, they don't want to train people. They want people who can come right in and do the job. And I think, you know, no reason not to want that. The question is, what do you do when you can't find it? Do you just give up or do you say, gee, maybe we'd be better off training somebody? So if you're a young person and you don't have job experience, how do you get it? Because nobody wants to give somebody that initial experience. Everybody wants to hire somebody who's currently employed by one of their competitors. So, you know, what do you do?
And the solution for a long time has been these unpaid internships, but that's really a challenge for people who are not able to afford working for a summer or a semester or a year, whatever it is, for free.
Oh, absolutely. And one college recruiter told me that they're seeing employers who will not give people internships unless the student has already had an internship someplace else.
What are they supposed to do?
Well, right. This is, you know, this is, on the one hand, perfectly understandable. You can, as long as you can be picky and supply way exceeds demand, you wouldn't, you'd be surprised that didn't happen. I think the question, again, is what happens when you're not finding those people? Do you just throw your hands up, or do you get more realistic?
Let's talk about getting realistic. On the surface, it would seem that HR managers and people who are doing the hiring have the best sense of what applicants are capable of and who's out there. But because of the way the process has been automated in recent years, they may not even the resumes of perfectly qualified people may not even reach them.
I think that's right, and this is an important thing to remember, that the employers are controlling virtually everything about the process. Hmm. They decide how a job is described and what the requirements are, and in some ways that's where the problem begins. Hiring managers always want somebody who is just terrific and just perfect as long as you can find them. In the old days, there used to be an HR recruiter who would be assigned to that hiring group, and they would say, you know, this is really a bit excessive. You don't need a PhD to do this job. You don't really need all that experience. But that pushback is gone because those people have been cut in the efforts to downsize and get slimmer. So now those requirements get immediately baked into software.
Mm-hmm.
And the software has no human judgment. And all the software can look for are things about your prior experience and your education. So if you don't have prior experience, you're pretty much out to lunch on that one. But even if you do, the software is only as good as the people who are asking the questions, and it's really difficult with software to really get at people's experience. If you haven't had exactly the experience that fits, identical to what the job requires, it's pretty difficult for software to tell if, for example, the combination of two experiences you had before equals what you're looking for. So, you know, you get kicked out of the pool. Hmm. A human could look at that resume and say, you know, I can see how you could do this job pretty easily, but software can't do that.
Yeah, and in the same way that a human might say, oh, well, this person has military experience or something valuable that's not directly related to the job but speaks to character and everything else, that doesn't work with the software.
Right. Mm-hmm. Software, you know, is not human. It's not that good. There's nothing wrong with software. The problem is if you push it too hard, if you expect it to rely on that to do everything. So somebody told me, for example, when I was writing this book, that they had 29,000 applicants for an engineering job, mm-hmm. and none of them made it through the screening process. And it's a pretty standard engineering job. It wasn't something really quirky. Well, how could that be, you say? Well, you know, the software, the way it works, it's a series of yes-no gates you have to clear. Do you have it or not? Do you have it or not? And because you have to clear all those gates, you're actually kind of multiplying the probability of clearing each one. So, for example, if the odds of clearing the first hurdle are 50%, so half the candidates will have that first hurdle cleared, and the odds of clearing the second one are 50%, then the odds of clearing both are 1 in 4, and the odds of clearing 10 are about 1 in 1,000.
Hmm.
So pretty soon, you know, you can start to see why you could get 29,000 people applying and none of them clear the hurdles.
And, you know, in the same situation, you might have, okay, so you have 50 people qualifying, but if the job doesn't pay enough, they're not interested, and therefore they're not going to take the job.
Right. And, you know, a lot of employers actually admit that. There's a manpower survey where they're asking employers about difficulties in hiring, and about 11% of the employers admitted we're not paying enough. So my guess is if 11% admit it, then the actual number is probably twice or more than that, that they're just not paying the market wage. And, you know, I think, you know, more power to them. Let them try. If you can get somebody to do it for less, you know, and you want to do that, okay. But when you can't find anybody, don't call it a labor shortage. Don't call it a skills gap. It's just a cheapness gap on your part.
You know, it's funny, Peter, reading the book sort of made me think about everybody's got that friend who can't find love in the world. And
yep.
At some point you have to say, you know, there's only one Miss Texas a year, so you might want to adjust
yep.
your standards.
Right, right. And I think that's part of the question here is why doesn't it happen? You know, why doesn't it happen, for example, that an employer will see somebody who's just about perfect, maybe they need a couple of days of ramp-up speed, maybe they need a little bit of training. Why don't they get hired? And I think this is something that's really peculiar to a lot of modern businesses, and that is the internal accounting systems are quirky, that are determining how well you're doing, because it's very easy for them to look at costs. So every aspect of the cost of operations can be tracked pretty easily. How much we're paying people, how many people are employed. The contributions from jobs are hard to track.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, you could imagine it actually looks like you're saving money in some of these accounting systems if you keep a job vacant. So, you know, it looks like you're saving money and you're the hiring manager and you're saying, geez, we're not finding anybody. Should we lessen our criteria? Should we look at some of these people who almost cleared the hurdles? Saying, well, you know, actually, they're telling us this is making our budget look good. So I guess we should just keep looking. No point in trying to rush to hire, right? Now, obviously, that's wrong. I mean, there's got to be something crazy with your accounting system if you can't see any benefits from even having the job filled. But that's the way a lot of these systems work. So there's not a lot of pressure to compromise.
And, of course, anybody who's worked in a department where a couple of jobs are left open understands that that puts a huge amount of strain on the employees who are there trying to do a job and a half.
Yes, and sometimes, you know, if you're sort of a cynical employer, you could say, well, you know, let's just push our folks harder and we'll just wait. If nobody quits, we must be okay. The problem is that when you do start to see problems, it's too late.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can't track whether you've lost opportunities because people are too busy to answer the phone or respond to inquiries. You can't easily assess what the probability is of making some of those current employees quit and go work someplace else where they're not overworking them quite so much. So, you know, I think our accounting is really incomplete. And the problem is, if we rely on the accounting for everything, we're in trouble, just like relying on the software to do all of our recruiting and hiring. We're in trouble. It's just not designed to do that much.
So when the software first came out, people talked about the time it would save, the effort it would save, the fact that it would not be susceptible to unintentional racial and gender bias, things like that. How did we get to this place where it's really in charge of us instead of the other way around?
Well, you know, I think, again, it's this idea of just chasing cost savings down and down and down and down until suddenly you start to realize that there are all kinds of problems being generated by it that you can't easily track. So how did it get to this situation? Well, you started laying off people in your organization and saying, well, we can do all this with software. And so there's no human judgment. There's nobody helping the recruiting manager decide what they need. There's nobody looking at applicants who have been initially screened by the software. So, you know, the software is necessary these days because there are so many applicants that it would be impossible for a recruiter to give a serious look at all of them. But I think what we've tried to do is to say, okay, well, let's just see if we can do it without a recruiter taking a serious look at any of them. You know, we'll just let the software do everything. And, you know, I think we're just being penny wise and pound foolish. But again, it's partly because it's sometimes difficult to see what the costs are of going too far. And if all you're doing is chasing those cost numbers down, this is where you end up.
My guest is Peter Capelli. He's professor of management and director of the Center for Human Resources at the Wharton School of Business. His new book is called Why Good People Can't Get Jobs, The Skills Gap, and What Companies Can Do About It. You can be part of this conversation by calling in now to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a graduate education flexible enough to allow you to explore what matters most to you. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Peter Capelli. He is professor of management and director of the Center for Human Resources at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is called Why Good People Can't Get Jobs, The Skills Gap and What Companies Can Do About It. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at kera.org. So, Peter, there is also this reality that when companies, for whatever reason, have to say goodbye to an employee they've really liked, and they are drawing up a list of qualifications and qualities for the next person to come along, it makes sense that they put everything down that they liked about the last applicant and don't necessarily realize that the same job can be done well in two different ways.
Well, that's a great point. And a great example of this is if you looked at the U.S. IT industry in the 1990s, when the modern industry was kind of born, only about 10% of the IT professionals in the U.S. had an academic degree in anything related to IT. So these are folks who sort of learned it, mainly as they went. So there are lots of different ways, as you say, to do the jobs. And frankly, the most important experience and most important skills and competencies are the ones that you learn on the job once you're there. So I think a good test for an employer when they've drawn up this job description of something they're looking for is to look at their current employees and say, would any of these folks get hired if this is the standard we're using to hire somebody now? And if the answer is no, and I think, frankly, in most cases, the answer is no, you might want to ask yourself realistically, what do we expect to get here?
It's funny to think about, for example, a degree requirement, and Steve Jobs and Bill Gates would not have been hired by, say, IBM.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's right. And the average American these days has considerably more education than their current job requires. So we're pretty overqualified in terms of academic degrees for what we're doing now.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Jim in Irving. Hi, Jim.
Hello. I'm Jim Daniel. I'm with PDS Tech. I'm an IT recruiter, and I need to say that this gentleman is spot on. Oftentimes, we'll be presenting perfectly qualified candidates to hiring managers, and because they don't have that very specific skill set, they won't even get an interview. I wanted to comment that there are really two ways to get around that we found that works with the software impediment. The one is when you are applying online or you are going through a software program, custom tailor your resume. If a job rec specifically asks for a specific skill set and you have it, put it word for word, verbatim, in your resume. If you don't have it, detail out specifically how the skill sets that you do have fit for it. The second way is really, I found, sidestep the entire process. Go to job fairs, meet recruiters, get on LinkedIn, join groups, social network. Social networking is a big thing right now that is really starting to replace a lot of the software. And it's because it's going back to the roots. It's going to the actual personal connection and meeting people. But I appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thanks so much for your call. What do you think about all that, Peter?
That sounds right to me. Actually, that's the advice I would have given. I mean, the hard thing is to say get around the software, but I think that's right. If you can do it, you can make the case as to why you can actually do the job. Sometimes that's impossible to do with software. There's in the book, I try to describe some of the things that experts have said about how to beat the software. There's a lot of quirky things, like software doesn't read graphics very well, and it doesn't read certain kinds of formats very well, so you have to think carefully about how your resume is actually distributed. Most places, though, are kind of getting away from scanning the resumes altogether and just asking you to input the information in the form that that they're looking for. But I think this point about tailoring it to the job is really important. For example, there's a big difference between taking a course in Java programming and actually having done Java programming. So you don't want to say just Java competency. You want to spell out for them exactly what you've done with it.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go to Scott in Dallas. Hey, Scott.
Hi. Yeah, I'm not sure if I totally buy the cost containment argument, because you think that brands like Coke and Anheuser-Busch wouldn't advertise as much. It's hard to imagine that they get many real returns on those advertising dollars because of their presence. But I do see that tax rates do have a big effect. You know, when we had much higher tax rates, companies created pensions. They train people. R&D and hiring, all that's deductible. And when you have really high tax rates, all those avenues suddenly become much more affordable and much more appealing.
What do you think, Peter?
Well, every expense of labor is deductible. So, you know, I think one of the things that's going on with employers now is that they are bidding up wages with some of these practices, right? So, for example, we used to hire people right out of college and train them. Now what we do instead is we go to business schools and we hire MBAs who have already worked someplace else before.
Mm-hmm.
Either way, we're paying, right? We used to pay on the training side. Now we're not training. We're just paying for higher wages. I think that the part of this that I find puzzling, and I was actually talking to a group of executives, of CEOs about this earlier in the week, and I asked them, you know, questions like this. I said, do you know what it costs you to keep a position vacant? Do you know what it costs you to train somebody and whether the payoff from that is higher than hiring somebody on the outside? Do you know what the premium is you have to hire from the outside? And, of course, the answer to this is no. The surprising thing is if you were to ask them the same questions about a part they're buying for manufacturing, they know that. You know, they know which vendor provides the best price for the part. They've thought about whether they could make it themselves or whether they should outsource it to somebody else. You know, they know all the answers to those questions for other components of business. But when it comes to labor, which is the most expensive component by far and the most important, they don't have a clue about it.
Well, talk about this. You mentioned earlier that ideally employers would love to hire somebody working for their competitors doing exactly the same job competently. Are they concerned that if they spend all this money and these resources and this time to train their employees, they are, in effect, priming them to go somewhere else for a little more money?
Well, I think, you know, it's a bit of a double-edged sword, because one of the main reasons people say they're leaving organizations is because they're not growing, they're not doing anything new, and I'm not advancing my career, so I got to go someplace else. Mm-hmm. So they leave if you don't train them as well. I think it is a real issue to think about how we can make investments in people and not immediately lose those investments. And this is something that's pretty new. Now, it's worth pointing out the reason this is a problem is because employers started to hire from each other. They decided not to train. They thought it was easier to hire from the outside. And once you start that ball down the hill, it's hard to turn it around, right? So if all your competitors are now hiring on the outside and you say, I want to be the one that goes in the other direction and trains my people first, you know, it's going to be pretty difficult if everybody's got their sights trained on you. But it's also important to note that there are a lot of industries and occupations where they do grow talent from within. For example, all law firms do this. All medical firms, medical people are trained this way. All consulting firms, all accounting firms, they hire young people, they develop them, and they lose them all in the space of a couple of years. How does that work for them? Well, because the learners are working as they learn, right? They're combining work and learning. These are like apprenticeship programs, and they work perfectly well, and we've known it for a long time. And there isn't any reason why other companies couldn't do much the same thing. I think at this point it's just a knee-jerk reaction. Oh, we can't train. And to some extent it's also because in some companies they've cut so much that they've gotten rid of their own training departments, and now they don't have that option. But it's worth asking the question, does it still make sense for us to do this? Why couldn't we train? What's that going to cost us, you know?
Is there any way that public policy could be brought into this situation to sort of help companies fulfill that training and bring in people who are qualified?
Well, I think in a lot of state and local communities, there are efforts to help employers get workers in the door. You know, it's important to remember that in the U.S., training and education is largely a local operation, not a federal operation. And so what you see happening at state and local levels is an effort to provide training to employers to get them to move. For example, North Carolina in particular has been very aggressive at this. telling potential employers that if you'll move to North Carolina, we'll provide you with a skilled workforce. We'll set up our community college systems to train people at least in the basic skills that are needed to do your job, and we'll work with you to figure out what those skills are, and you know, we'll try to get as close to perfect training as we can get for your people. And, you know, there are worse ways to subsidize employers, for sure. But I think it's also important for employers to figure out, you know, is there a way we can do this and make it pay for us, you know? If we can train people, that means we can hire cheaply because we're hiring people who don't have skills, and we can train exactly for what we want. We can do it probably much faster than if we tried to outsource it to some third party. And I think at the moment, you know, the community colleges, which are trying to carry the bulk of this, are so strapped for resources that their programs are just jammed up. You know, you can't get in them because so many people are trying to go back to school and get some of these quite specific skills. But I should point out that even there, it doesn't always work. So, for example, my son, who has a classics degree from college and didn't expect to be particularly employable and was interested in healthcare stuff. So he went back to a community college and got a healthcare certificate, you know, one of these certificates that we hear is so in demand in the field of healthcare. Well, it turns out it's not in demand. It turns out they only want people who've already got experience doing those jobs. And sometimes, too, they're combining certificates. They want you to have two certificates crossing fields to do the same job that people used to have doing only one. So, you know, there's no magic bullet here for the job seekers. It's not like, gee, if I only get this certificate, I'll get a job. You know, employers are still looking for that work experience, which is the hardest thing to come by.
So we're always going to have, as part of the applicant pool, folks who, for whatever reason, are unemployed. Right now, it's particularly pronounced, the situation of people by no fault of their own having been laid off from struggling firms. How serious is the stigma of not having a job when you are applying for a job?
Well, you know, at the moment, it seems to be a real stigma. There are a lot of employers who are saying they won't look at applicants from people who are currently unemployed. And the reason for this is they think maybe some of those folks are unemployed because they were pushed out. They were the first fired when the business went down. Maybe they think their skills are a little rusty because they've been unemployed for a while. But again, it's you know, it's kind of really unfair because you could find answers to those questions more easily than simply discriminating against the whole class of people because, you know, they were unemployed. I mean, sometimes they're unemployed because their company went out of business, you know, or the plant closed. It had nothing whatsoever to do with anything related to their skills. I think the general policy point about this, however, is that it's reinforcing this problem of inequality. If you don't have a job now, it's almost impossible to get one. If you're starting out, it's almost impossible to get your foot in the door. If you are somebody who currently has a job, you have tremendous advantages in getting the next job as opposed to those people who have lost a job. So, you know, it's again, it's part of this story of the haves and the have-nots, and it seems to be getting a lot worse.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Ken on the line next in Fort Worth. Hi, Ken.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm not looking for work anymore. But in the 90s, when there was a whole bunch of us unemployed, employers, as you've mentioned, can raise the number of requirements they're looking for. I'm in the IT area. And we were seeing ads in the paper and job listings for a company's proprietary software. No one would know that if they don't work for the company.
Right.
They were trying to get people in there with H-1B visas, and they were trying to prove that there was no one available on the market.
Right. I've heard lots of stories of things like that. You know, I heard from one job seeker who told me that the HR people had told him at the end of the process, at least he got to talk to somebody, that they couldn't hire him because he hadn't had the equivalent job someplace else, And it turned out the job title here was something that was completely unique to the company. So it was impossible to have, for him to have had the job before because it didn't exist anywhere else, you know. So that's a great example of the catch-22 that we're seeing.
And so many people have a friend, or maybe they've been through this situation themselves, where they see a job listing and they think, oh my gosh, I've never read a more perfect description. But if you can't, you know, get to the place where you make your elevator speech, it sounds like you've got no shot in many cases.
I think that's right. You know, I think particularly, as the last caller was saying, in the field of IT, this seems to be the craziest situation because this is where employers are complaining the most. And this is also where job seekers are the most frustrated. And I think the reason is because this is where software could get things so clearly wrong. For example, database managers. Well, it turns out from people I talk to that, you know, there's a common skill to managing and running databases. And some of them differ a lot. But, you know, for the most part, if you're good at it, it only takes you a couple of hours to learn a new system. But if you plug in and build into the job requirements and into the software, must have experience with X, Y, or Z database, you're basically ruling out a whole category of people who could do the job with very minimal effort. But if you don't require that, then what do you require? Then it takes a little skill to try to put a requirement in there that isn't so broad that everybody fits it, you know. So it requires, you know, these things require a certain amount of judgment, a certain amount of skill, and the people who had that judgment and skill are gone. They're out of the system because we replace them with software.
Peter Capelli is my guest. He's professor of management and director of the Center for Human Resources at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. His new book is called Why Good People Can't Get Jobs, The Skills Gap and What Companies Can Do About It. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Peter Capelli of the Wharton School of Business. His new book is called Why Good People Can't Get Jobs, The Skills Gap and What Companies Can Do About It. Peter, talk about this. Another potential pitfall that job applicants need to navigate is this question that comes right off the bat when they're filling out these online forms, and that is salary requirements. Now, employees are not necessarily told what the job might pay. They just almost have to take a shot in the dark sometimes.
Yeah, isn't that a sneaky one? They're asking you in the question, what wage are you looking for? You as an applicant are trying to guess, gee, what's too high? Because if I guess too high, my application will be thrown out. But what's too low in the sense that what could I actually live with? Would I really want this job, mm-hmm. for example, if it paid too little? So the problem with this is, you know, at the end of the day, a lot of people who guess too high, their application is going to be thrown out.
It's like the old showcase showdown on Price is Right, because you're thrown out, even though if they came back to you and said, we want you, but it's $3,000 less than you stated, lots of people might say absolutely.
You might say yes, right. Mm-hmm. And so I think the problem with this is if you're going to do this as an employer, please don't tell me afterwards that there weren't qualified applicants.
Mm-hmm. Know?
It's really just a question of what you're looking to pay. And you're trying to run an auction, you know, see who will do this as cheaply as possible. Well, you know, I guess if you want to do that, you can do it. I guess you do have to start asking yourself, if you do that, why am I surprised if people quit afterwards, right?
Yeah.
As soon as if you're looking for the cheapest person to do this job, should you be surprised if your current employees are willing to quit and go work for somebody else for a couple of bucks more?
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Sherry on the line in Plano. Hey, Sherry.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
On the show. I'm actually a recruiter. I have been for 12 years, worked for agencies, corporate. I work for a company where we do a lot of different types of recruiting and screening. And I got a couple things. First thing, I'm not denying that it can be an issue with software. I've worked with a lot of large companies who their process was too complicated and they didn't really, you know, it's a tool. They didn't really know how to use it. But for the most part, if we didn't have this type of software, people wouldn't be getting hired as fast as they are, even in this economy. It allows me to actually spend time on the phone with candidates who are actually qualified. You know, I may have a job where I'll get 300 people apply in a week, and we use very basic questions that would rule out a candidate when they first apply that we ask, you know, usually no more than 3 to 5, and everything else, if they look good, we do on the phone. But I think the biggest issue with software is, or when people apply online many times, is because they get rejected by the software because, as I think Jim called in and mentioned, people don't tailor their resumes or they don't follow a process. I mean, I've worked for companies where applying online was so very easy and people just wouldn't take the 5 minutes to fill out a couple fields or to make sure that they actually had a full resume in there. They just put in a cover letter, which, you know, sometimes if I have time, I'll ask someone to, I'll email them and ask them to send me a resume. But other times, if I've got all these people that haven't even bothered to follow the process, I've got to focus on people who are qualified. I mean, it's a tool. It can be misused as anything else, but it allows me to work on, you know, maybe 25 jobs and recruit people as opposed to only being able to work on 5 a week. So,
what do you think about that? All that, Peter?
No, that sounds right. I think the idea is it's a tool. And I think given that we have made it so easy to apply, this started in the 90s when there was a tight labor market and employers were trying to find ways to get more applicants in the door. And so that's when they moved to, you know, make it easy for you to apply online. You could do it on their website. You didn't have to send resumes in it anymore. It was done, at least in large part, to allow for more applicants. Because we got so many applicants now, there's no way humans could do this themselves, so you have to have something to do the initial screening. And I think that's the good use of this stuff is, you know, initial screening. And I think as your caller was suggesting, that's the way they do it. They have pretty broad screens, pretty simple screens for, you know, for things that you need, like credentials or licenses or something like that. And then after that, it gets looked at by people. But I think what we're seeing and where the problem is those jobs where we don't see that, where they use it to generate the short list at the end, and poof, nobody comes out at the end of the process.
So this issue of tailoring one's resume to match up with the required skills in order to make it through those hurdles that are set up by the software, it makes perfect sense. I wonder, though, if it's also an incentive for people to stretch the truth so that at least they can get their foot in the door and get an interview.
Yeah, I think that's unfortunate. And I think, you know, there's a fine line between gaming the system and lying. Mm-hmm. And I think, unfortunately, what the software does is it probably encourages people to stretch that line a fair bit, precisely for the reason you say. You know, they've got a story that's pretty complicated. It takes, you know, some time to explain why they're qualified for the job, combination of different experiences, let's say. And they can't do that with the software, so they, you know, they just say they're qualified, and, you know, it's possible that it's true, depending on your view of what the requirement says, but, you know, it does raise some interesting ethical questions.
We haven't talked about this yet, but, of course, we all also have had experience with someone who looks perfect on paper, and for whatever reasons, even sort of social chemistry, they're not a good fit for the job.
Well, you know, that's a great point because I think there's this view of people who are not in the recruiting or selection area that, you know, there are good candidates for job and there are bad candidates for job, and it's very clear what the distinction is. That's really not true. You know, even with the very best selection devices, we're lucky if we can predict half the variance in advance, mm-hmm, of job performance. We're just not that good at picking how well people are going to do on a job. And the reason for that is because a lot of job performance is situational. Depends where you are in your life. It depends what's happening to you outside of work. It depends how motivated you are. It depends a lot on how you're managed inside the organization.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not just about bringing in raw meat, you know, it's about how you're managed. So, you know, obsessing over whether this person perfectly meets the criteria or not is probably a waste of time, given that, because, you know, we're just not that good at being able to predict anyway.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Adrian on the line in Dallas. Hey, Adrian.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Actually, your guest said something really interesting to me earlier about how, I guess, interns or when they recruit people out of college, it's work to learn and learn to work. And I feel that most jobs would be smart to do that throughout the career. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, someone who's done the exact same job, why would I want to hire someone who's going to be doing that exact same thing again? I mean, I've worked for 20-something years now, and that just, I know, leads to boredom and, on some level, disenfranchises employees. To me, if someone meets probably 50%, more like 60% of the requirements and has vast work experience, could also be an older person, they would be much more suited to the job in that they'll be learning on the job. And when you go into work and you're constantly learning, I just find that that's just, you know, a more fun day in general.
That's a really interesting point, the idea that maybe what you still have to learn could be an asset.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, you know, the idea of developing people for bigger jobs inside your own organization is the way most companies used to operate. You know, they primarily grew their talent from within. So, you know, this takes us back to the earlier question where we started. You know, what's really going on here? What's new? What's new is employers are asking for something different than they used to ask for. And what they're asking for now is people who are already trained, already skilled, can step right into the job. They're not looking for people who could be groomed, you know, to do a bigger job. And, you know, some of this also has to do with the peculiarity of the way a lot of modern businesses are structured, particularly larger businesses. So, you know, we've created these profit and loss centers inside a big business. So your local manager is responsible for all their costs and all their profits. And if I go to my local manager and say, you know, boss, I've really got an interest in doing something bigger than what I'm doing now. Well, if that bigger job takes me out of that boss's profit and loss center, that boss has got no interest in having me do it.
Yeah.
Unless the company at the corporate level or the overall company level makes a commitment and says it is important for you to grow talent and for people to advance to other jobs elsewhere, I've kind of got a disincentive to do that. I don't have any incentive to pay to train you to do a bigger job. You know, the problem then is I probably lose the people anyway, but I probably don't lose them as fast as if I had grown them into a new role that they can't do with me.
Is part of this a factor of the intensive specialization that the workforce has gone through? Because, you know, the days when, you know, my grandparents were working and people would quite literally start in the mailroom and work up are over.
Yeah. And I think that's all part of the same story. And the story is about whether we grow talent from within or we hire it from the outside. So, you know, a generation ago in the U.S., in big corporations, only about 10% of vacancies were filled by going outside the company. 90% were filled by promotions or by movements around the organization. You're changing jobs to try different roles to keep you fresh or learn new things. And at the moment, the evidence suggests that something like 2/3 of all vacancies are filled by going outside.
Wow.
And, you know, that means basically that, you know, we're not growing our talent from within. And just to see how this spills over, the fact that I am hiring from the outside makes it difficult for you, your company, to grow talent from within because I keep hiring your people away from you because I want somebody who is trained and I'm not willing to train them myself. So it becomes this vicious circle. And then you can see, as we're seeing now, employers saying, gee, I can't find the people I want to do the jobs I need done. The reason for that is because what I want is somebody who's currently doing the same job for somebody else. Oh, and by the way, I don't want to pay them more money. And they've got to be able to come in with no training, no uptime.
Let's go to the phones one final time. We have Ethan on the line in Dallas. Hi, Ethan.
Hi, how you doing?
Great, thank you.
Thanks again for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I had a quick question. I have been out of school for a year, and I have yet to find a job online. I was wondering what you, what you recommend for guys like me who don't have a lot of experience, are looking to find whatever experience they can, and what I can do to avoid these online hiring software programs and frugal hiring managers looking for the best qualified candidates.
Ethan, we don't have too much time to get your answer, but what field are you looking to work in?
Advertising.
Okay. Any thoughts, Peter?
Well, you know, as I say, I've got a son in the same position, so I'm acutely sensitive to this. I think, if you can afford it, as we were saying before, volunteering someplace so that you can say you've had experience in the context, so you can persuade somebody that you can start making contributions early on. I have another son who was trying to get access to a particular field, and he basically begged the guy and said, look, you don't have to pay me. I'll clean up. I'll do anything. I just want to follow you around and see what you're doing. And that seemed to be persuasive. Now, you know, the problem is not everybody can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody's got the resources where they can work for nothing for a while. But I'd say, you know, anything to get your foot in the door anywhere probably, you know, makes sense. I'd say the last thing, though, for people who are in your situation is don't take it personally. You know, the job market is terrible right now. It's the worst job market since the Great Depression. And the fact that you don't have a job is not necessarily because you're a bad person or you couldn't do the job.
Do you find that a lot of HR folks read this book and say, absolutely, if only we could convince our clients that this is the way it needs to change?
Yeah, I'd say, you know, when I first did a story in the Wall Street Journal about this in the fall,
right.
And I'd say about a third of the responses, I had 500 emails responding to me, about a third of them were people in human resources or recruiting, and they were almost without exception, complaining about the way things worked. And they were, you know, the complaints are with the hiring managers or with the resources we've got or with the way we're using applicant tracking systems. It's, you know, it's just they're squeezing down penny-wise, pound-foolish seems to be the story.
Peter Capelli is professor of management and director of the Center for Human Resources at the Wharton School. His new book is called Why Good People Can't Get Jobs, The Skills Gap and What Companies Can Do About It. Peter, thank you so much for joining us and good luck to your son.
Thank you.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Christine McConnell produces the podcast and our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. If you have a comment or a question or a suggestion, email that to us. The address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.